We know that God is a jealous God. We know that He won't share His glory with another. When it comes to our eternal salvation, His supreme work of deliverance and redemption, God certainly doesn't want man to be able to boast at all in terms of having any type of meritorious role in salvation. So we humbly bow the knee. We thank God. We acknowledge that it's by grace through faith that we have been saved. It's not of our own doing. It's entirely the work of God. When we come to the book of Judges and what we've been working through in these cycles of sin and salvation and deliverance, we've been seeing some snapshots of lesser types of deliverances. You know, when you compare them to our eternal salvation, these are snapshots that have a little bit of a foretaste of what salvation is about, a little bit of their typical, in some sense, of salvation. Each of these makes somewhat of a contribution to our understanding of how God is able to deliver us as the ultimate warrior that He is, and yet God works through, in Judges, we see how God works through different individuals, but individuals that sometimes are very surprising in terms of whom He picks to work through, the weapons that He chooses to use. We see that God does all of these things in order that He might receive the glory. There's unique aspects in each account that we look at. As you look at each individual, you know, Shamgar, he had his ox goad, you know, and so that's a unique aspect that you sort of focus in on. Ehud, you know, and his two-edged sword and just how he had his devious plot there to defeat Eglon. You know, there's just interesting aspects of each of these accounts that we try to highlight the things that are there for emphasis. And this morning, the interesting aspect is the role of women in leadership. Something that's surprising to us, understanding the overall context of Scripture, the role of men and women, and what God has laid out in typical fashion as to how we operate in the different spheres that God has created and placed us into. So we find it surprising, and it's part of that gives us the interest in this account here in Judges chapter 4 and 5. We're going to see how God uses Deborah, a prophetess, in a unique role of leadership in her area there in Israel, as well as a non-Israelite woman, Jael, and how He uses her in a significant fashion to ultimately kill the enemy that had been plaguing Egypt. When it comes to Deborah, she seems to be the only woman that stands out with the type of prominent leadership role that we see here. We see other women that are identified as prophetesses and ones through whom God spoke in limited time frame and limited capacity, but Deborah's role seems to be expanded. It seems to be quite distinct. I mean, you might remember Miriam, the sister of Moses back in Exodus chapter 15, and how God spoke through her in a couple instances. There was a woman that I didn't remember, Huldah, H-U-L-D-H, Huldah, who spoke for God in the time of Josiah back in 2 Kings chapter 22. And then you get into the New Testament, and you would find various women that might be identified as prophetesses. Now, people, as they come to this section, sometimes I think people get off track and they think that maybe this historical account that we're reading here should sort of lead us down the path of lobbying for an expanded role of women in places of church leadership. And so they take this and say, well, let's head down that path. But I think as you study the emphasis today that God puts in this section, we'll see that really, what God is doing is to put the focus back on Him by showing that he's using people that we wouldn't expect for Him to use, just like He used the ox goad. Not to compare the women to the ox goad, but just in terms of the unusual expectation, God, we're seeing that what God is doing is saying, when it all comes down to it, all of the glory for salvation and deliverance has to go back to God. Now, there might be some derived honor that comes to Jael as being the woman that God uses in that situation, as opposed to Barak, who could have had that honor, But because of his hesitancy, he was denied that particular honor. But ultimately, it's God who is seen as the one who is sovereignly behind the scenes, pulling all the strings, orchestrating all that happens, controlling the forces of nature to bring about great warfare victory for the nation of Israel. And it's God who is the one that wants to receive all of the glory. And so we have to keep in mind that, you know, nothing here is undermining the New Testament teaching that elders are required to be men, that in terms of teaching and ruling in an authoritative fashion in the public church gatherings, it's men who are to do that public teaching and leadership role. This account here is not meant to undermine that, but on the other hand, it is meant to raise our level of expectation of how God uses each individual and how prominent women are in God's sovereign plan for how he wants to use people, how he wants to endow them with certain capabilities, and then how he wants to bless the results from them. And so we don't want to overlook what God is doing in, whether it's through children, whether it's through women, whether it's through whoever that God is working through. So all of that we want to keep in balance. But I would say that what I learned from these two chapters, we're just going to look at chapter 4, even though these are juxtaposed. You've got a historical account in chapter 4, which is in narrative form, and then you have the poetic account, which is the celebration, sort of the Thanksgiving ode that's in chapter 5. But many of the details that you need to understand the incident actually come from chapter 5, from the poetic portion. So those two are presented from two different perspectives, historical narrative and poetry, and they both dovetail together to give us the full picture of what God is doing. But what I learned from this is that God uses unconventional means, whether it's the ox goad that we studied a week ago, whether it's the leadership role of women, of Deborah and Jael that we study here, but he uses unconventional means to ensure that the glory for salvation belongs ultimately to him alone. So we want to make sure that what we do is follow through on what God's intent is here, that we glorify him as the great warrior, the great deliverer, the one who accomplishes salvation for us against all odds, in things where it looks impossible, how God steps into our situation and intervenes and is our rescuer, our deliverer, our stronghold, and the one in whom we put all of our faith. One of the commentators, I think, has this right. His name is Block. And he says, too often modern agendas are imposed upon these ancient documents, like some of the feminist approaches that would come and how they would treat this passage here. In their enthusiasm to celebrate the subversion of patriarchy, in other words, instead of male leadership in the household, they would take this as an example of where you have female leadership. And yet what they end up doing is subverting the authority of God and obscuring the message that he seeks to communicate through this text. The biblical author was obviously interested in women's affairs and in their achievement. But in the final analysis, Deborah and Jael are not heroic figures because of their revisionist challenges to prevailing social structures. They are heroines because of what they accomplish as agents of the divine agenda, which in this instance has less to do with overthrowing oppressive patriarchy than the role they play in Yahweh's overthrowing oppressive Canaanites. The entire account is deliberately crafted to highlight the salvation provided by God. He is the chief operator, pulling the strings, raising generals, deploying armies, dictating strategy, and effecting victory. In the end, both the narrative of chapter 4 and the poetic song of chapter 5 celebrate the saving work of Yahweh. And that will be our emphasis as we come. If you read this with me, chapter 4, we're going to read just the first 16 verses, and then we'll cover the rest of it subsequently. But let's follow through and concentrate on the first 16 verses of Judges chapter 4. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So we see what kicks this cycle off once again, this repetitive cycle that we've been tracing through the book of Judges. And this happened after Ehud died. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. The sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely. for 20 years. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand." Then Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." She said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." At this point, I'm sure he thought that she's speaking of herself, of Deborah, but it doesn't turn out to be Deborah in this case for the prophecy. Then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kedesh. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zananim, which is near Kedesh. Then they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots. Don't get that number wrong. That's a big number. He had 900 chariots. There's no mistake about it. He had 900 chariots. Okay. And all the people were with him, from Harosheth the Goyim to the river Kishon. Deborah said to Barak, "Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you." So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. The Lord routed Sisera. It was the Lord, you see. It was the Lord that routed Sisera and all his chariots. That's the key phrase right there. And all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. And then there's the account of Sisera fleeing away on foot and getting nailed by jail. We'll get to that. But in terms of the structure of this passage, put something up here that shows in terms of the Hebrew way of parallelism. You know, they do this sort of A, B, C, D, C, B, A type of structure. They have that type of balancing structure in a lot of the accounts that they write, and so you can see the balance as we track through it. You might reference this where at the beginning of the account you see the sons of Israel oppressed, and then in verses 23 to 24, when he sums things up, we see that he's talking about Jabin, the king of Canaan, and how Canaan is subdued. So the contrast between Israel and between Canaan, the contrast between Deborah the prophetess in verses 4 to 9, one of the heroines, and the other heroine, Jael, the wife of Heber, in verses 17 to 22. You have the account of Barak and Sisera in verses 10 to 13, and again in verses 14 to 16. But at the heart of it, verses 14 to 15, you have Yahweh the warrior and what he accomplishes in the overthrowing, in the victory that he brings about. So just some of that parallelism, I think, works itself through here. But we're going to be, if you follow the outline in the back of your bulletin, we're going to track through the same cycle that we've seen in the other accounts of the judges, placing the emphasis on the aspect of salvation and deliverance. That's where the bulk of the story takes place. So first of all, with respect to sin, we see that the Lord's character must be revered. He must be feared. He has his name at stake. Every time that we sin, we are basically taking a swipe in rebellion against God's character. For God is holy. God's called us to be holy because he is holy. And God expects us to be free from sin. He wants our character to be consistent with his character. So anytime we deviate from the character of God, that's when we are involved with sin. And so we see this slippage that we've talked about, when they have a time of peace, whether it's 40 years or 20 years, it's different periods of time, but after Ehud, and you had this time of peace, and until the point where Ehud died, when they're in that time of peace, as we said, instead of building themselves up and becoming more mature in the faith and becoming more godly, they're actually getting complacent and they're getting sidetracked from what God has called them to do, and they're being sloppy in terms of how they're living, and they're setting themselves up for defeat because they put their focus on the visible leader that God has provided rather than on the invisible God himself, so that there's this big downturn when Ehud passes away, and it says the sons of Israel again slip into evil in the sight of the Lord and do sin. Just like Romans chapter 12 verses 1 and 2 talk about the need for us to be wholly dedicated to the Lord so that our minds are transformed rather than being conformed to the thinking patterns of this age, rather than having worldliness come in and take us over so that we're corrupted with the world, that we stand out as different from the world, as ones that, again, have the character of God, that have a loyal allegiance to the Lord, who is our righteousness. But instead, we see them fall into this depraved worship of idolatry that was associated with the Canaanites where they were living, and it's just this central environment, this corrupt and this evil, wicked environment. One commentator, Davis, points out something about sin that I found interesting. He says, it's difficult to be creative in sin. There's a certain monotony about it. All of it's been done before. It's simply we end up doing the same thing over and over. And that's what Judges comes back to. It's not different sins even that they're involved in. They come back and they fall into the same sinful patterns that they have. Isn't that true with each of us? It's different what the patterns are for each of us. We each have our own patterns of sinfulness that tend to give us trouble. And it's different for different people as to what causes us to slip up. But it's not that it's sin is so new and creative and different. It's just we fall into that same monotonous pattern. It might look exciting. It might look enticing up front. But as you get into it, it's just the same old type of pattern. And it's interesting, too, that all of those enemies that Joshua had overthrown when he came into the land, and you study through the different chapters in Joshua, how many of these cities and places sort of popped their ugly heads up again? You know, you thought you sort of had squashed them, but you hadn't really been vigilant. You hadn't kept your eye on them and kept them down, and the enemy sort of pops back up in different places. And that's what we see as we go through this book of Judges, is places where you thought, well, I thought that had been dealt with in the past, and yet they arise again and cause trouble for God's people. So it starts with, the cycle starts with sin, with the sons of Israel doing evil, and then it moves to suffering. That link that's there all the time between sin and bondage and oppression and the agony of God's people when they're under the thumb of the enemy. So it says in verse 2, the Lord sold them. The Lord is the one who sold them. That word means to turn them over, to give them up, to abandon them to the life that they had chosen. They had chosen this life for themselves, and the Lord basically sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. That name Jabin is a dynastic name that's used, like Pharaoh is used in Egypt. So it's a name that's used over and over again for whoever the ruling person is in that land. So that's a common title that you see repetitively come up. And so this Jabin, who's the present king of Canaan, he's the figure behind the scenes. You don't see a lot as we read through this account. You don't hear a lot about Jabin because he has his man up front on the front lines. He has Sisera, the commander of his army. He's the one that we see being engaged actively against God's forces. But Jabin is the one, just like Satan is the one who's behind the scenes, who has all of his forces and who's doing all of these things sort of in an invisible sense. Jabin is sort of in that role in this context here. He's the ultimate enemy against what God is trying to do in terms of his program. But he's reigning in this city, Hazor, and the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Now, if you turn back to Joshua chapter 11, you'll see what I mentioned about, hey, I thought this city of Hazor, I thought we had dealt with that pretty decisively back in Joshua chapter 11. Remember in this account, when northern Palestine was being taken, you see in chapter 11, verse 1 of Joshua, it came about when Jabin, see that it's not the same individual back then. It's the same name, just like Pharaoh is used in that sense. Jabin, king of Hazor, when he heard of it, then he sent to Jobab, king of Madian. He's trying to get an alliance together to fight against the people of Israel. In verse 6, then the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So they've got a history of having chariots. Now, whether these were iron ones or whether the iron ones came a little bit later, they were able to burn these ones, so I don't know. But so it says, Joshua and all the people who were with him, they came upon them suddenly, and it says they defeated them. It says in verse 9, Joshua hamstrung their horses. He burned their chariots. And then verse 10, he captured Hazor, the city. He struck its king, Jabin, with the sword. For Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. And he talks about striking them all down and burning the city, you know, so that nothing was left. So at the end of verse 13, he burned. So this is an account that you think back to. It wasn't that long ago, a few generations back. And yet here, you have, because of that, apparently that locale was a fertile area for the Canaanites to sort of take root and try to have a base of operations. And so here you have them now have they've gained the place of ascendancy over Israel. Now they have Israel in subjection. And so you see quite a turnabout that sin has caused from the victory that God wanted his people to have. Remember, John chapter 8, verse 34 says, everyone who commits sin is the slave of sin. There's that bondage that takes place when we give ourselves over, instead of being our members being servants of righteousness, when we give our members over to be servants to sin. And so this time we have this new king who's aided by this brilliant general named Sisera, who's able to cause great difficulty and hardship for the people of Israel. When it says here that how long, as you get to the supplication that Israel makes in verse 3. So you have sin and you have the suffering, and now you have the supplication in verse 3. We can see the hardship they were under. It says the sons of Israel cried to the Lord for this King Jabin and his commander Sisera. He had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. See, these chariots made it impossible for Israel to defend the valley areas. Okay, they couldn't be effective up in the mountainous regions, but down in the fertile areas where you had all the crops growing, you had all the food supply, you had all the activity down in those more level areas of the valleys and the plains, those chariots were unstoppable. Can you imagine having a military force where you had infantrymen who were very poorly armed against tanks, you know, who are rolling through everything and are just kind of indestructible? I mean, it's just no contest as how they were equipped. In fact, in chapter 5, we see the mention that the Israelites, in verse chapter 5, verse 4, it says, not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. That's an interesting number, too, because it starts with, in our chapter, we're going to see 10,000 mentioned, but at some point there's an additional 30,000 Israelites that come in to give us a total of 40,000. But what I wanted to look at here was the fact that it makes reference to, we weren't even equipped with spears and shields and things that you had these weapons probably confiscated by the enemy. You were under the thumb of this iron rule of the Canaanites, and not only did you not have the chariots, you didn't have some of the normal weapons that the infantrymen would probably even want. So they're very poorly equipped. They don't have anywhere near the resources that the enemy has. And so we see that it's just a very difficult situation, and they're under tremendous oppression. You can imagine that the enemy would swoop down at harvest time and just take whatever you had worked upon. Where's the incentive to work and to yield some type of a harvest? They're just going to swoop down and take whatever they want. They're going to pillage the village. They're going to take whatever they want for their own gain. I think sometimes in our situation, we take our liberties for granted because we've grown up with freedom. We haven't known oppression. And the misery that people are subjected to in other parts of the world, we have difficulty being empathetic or having any connection with that because emotionally and in our experience, we haven't seen that. And yet there are people throughout the world that are living in refugee status because they've been driven from their village, from their homeland, from their place of sustenance and where they could take care of themselves and work for themselves. They've been driven away from that by cruelty and by oppression and by the wickedness of people that just exploit others and take advantage of others. And so they live in fear and they live in terror. And that's what was confronting the people of Israel at this time, is a hopeless type of situation where they couldn't see their way out from under. And for 20 years, as their children grew up and as Deborah grew up in this environment, it seemed so hopeless. And yet we see in this highlighted passage before us, we see the magnificence of God's salvation, the might of God, and how he is able to deliver whatever the situation is. So verses 4 to 24, the heart of the passage, speaks to this issue of salvation. The Lord's salvation, his salvation exploits must glorify him. He's the one that does the work of saving, and he's the one that must be glorified. So we're going to work our way through the heart of the passage here, beginning in verse 4. We see, first of all, the prominence of Deborah. A very exalted role for a woman. God has raised up an amazing lady leader. It says that Deborah is a prophetess. Her name means honeybee. I don't know if you can make too much out of that. You know, whether she's judging, so she's dispensing nuggets of sweet nuggets, I guess, but she's got that sting. I thought of Muhammad Ali, you know, his famous phrase, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, you know, and he packed a punch. And Deborah was a very powerful woman, very influential woman from the first time we see her here. It's referenced that she's married, but her husband has no place of prominence. I mean, Lapidoth, we don't hear anything else about him in Scripture. It would be just conjecture to say what his role was or wasn't, but she's the one that definitely has the prominence in the passage. Now, we know from Isaiah chapter 3, verse 12, that typically when God places children or women in places of leadership, from Isaiah chapter 3, verse 12, it's mentioned that it's a sign of almost humiliation. It's a sign that the men have not stepped up to the plate and taken what their role should be, and that it's somewhat of a shame to the nation. You don't get that sense here in terms of the context with Deborah. You know, whether it is because of anything negative on the part of male leadership, it doesn't say, but it just says very positively. It's something that, this isn't something that Deborah has usurped a position for herself or has taken something over that she shouldn't be involved with. This is something that it seems that God has definitely raised her up and equipped her to do, because the very fact that she's a prophetess could only be the work of God. She couldn't make herself be a prophetess. She couldn't push herself into that role. She had to be divinely appointed to that role. God is saying, I'm going to speak through her as my mouthpiece. She's going to be the one that communicates either my words of judgment to differentiate right from wrong as you bring those situations before her. I'm going to give her that wisdom so that she can make those calls that will be good and will benefit the people. But also, if it's words of prophecy in terms of speaking of future events and what will take place, prophecy in either context has to do with God directly communicating his mind and will and then using her as the spokesperson to tell that to the people. What respect she built up. What a following she built up among the people, where they were accustomed to count it a privilege to go before her in the place where she didn't have to go to them. I mean, she was the draw. They came to her. She was in a place that was centrally located. They knew where she sort of had her shop there under the palm tree. And they would come and they would expect to be blessed by the words of wisdom and the righteous judgments and the things that she would be able to dispense there. So she's very respected by all of the people. So this prominence of Deborah is the first interesting part of this story that strikes us as different, because this role with the woman being in place of leadership is very different from what we're accustomed to see throughout the rest of Scripture. And then we see her partnership with Barak. Barak is unwilling to engage the enemy without Deborah, even though God alone is the one who gives the victory. So it says in verse 6, now she sent and she summoned. See, she's the one in authoritative position to summon Barak. Barak's not the one to summon her. So she's in this position of authority where she summons Barak, the son of Abinoam. And she says to him, in a very authoritative sense, she says, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded. I am conveying to you a message that God has given to me to say, this is what you need to obey. This is a command from God. This isn't some option. This isn't God's recommendation for, well, if you want to have a happy day today, this is, you know, you might want to consider trying this approach. It might be a good way to. No, this is, God is saying, this is what you need to do. You are under obligation before the divine authority, God, not even before Deborah, before God. You are bound to obey what God is commanding you here. Go and march to Mount Tabor. And take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. Now, this is not an attractive assignment on the first blush. This has to look like a suicide mission to anyone who has any common sense and understanding of the enemy. You're going to create such a ruckus, and you're going to bring the attention of the enemy to this Mount Tabor, where as soon as you come down off of this mountain, you're surrounded by these flat areas where the chariots of the enemy are going to be able to completely dominate you. So you are trapped in this mountain region with this force of men, and as soon as the enemy is aware that that's where you've got, they're not going to be able to hide that that's where you are. It's going to be evident to the enemy where you are, and you are completely exposed. You are completely unprotected. You are almost taking the nation of Israel and just wiping them out. You're taking all of these troops and condensing them, centralizing them in this one area for them to be wiped out by a superior enemy that you have no chance against. This is not, you know, on first blush, this is not an attractive assignment. And yet, look at the promise that Deborah gives along with the command. She says, what God has said is that he will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin. Well, that's a great promise. Okay, so I'll have the enemy there, and I'll have all of his chariots, and I'll have all of his troops at the river Kishon, which is a flat riverbed, really a creek, not much of a river at this point in time. It's the dry season here in Israel. So this river, there's nothing happening here with this river at this point because it's the dry season. And so you're saying, okay, so God's going to call everybody together so that we're going to have this great conflict. And both forces are going to be aligned against each other. The promise is, I will give him, this commander Sisera, I will give him into your hand. That's been the message throughout Joshua and Judges. The message is, God's going to give the victory. I want to give, do you want victory? I want to give you victory. Do you want victory? And that's the message that God brings to us as Christians. He says, Christ has the victory. I will give you the victory. Do you want victory? Do you want to submit your members as members of righteousness? Do you want to acknowledge that when Christ died, you died there to sin with Christ on the cross? You've been raised up to new life. You've been made a new creature in Jesus Christ. All old things have passed away. All things have become new. You now have the opportunity to live without fear, without anxiety, without hopelessness, but to live in victory and in peace. That's what God is offering here. And you would think that Barak, in one sense, you would think that Barak would seize this as a tremendous opportunity. And yet, I don't think we should be too harsh on Barak. I mean, our first reading is to say, Barak, what a yellow streak. You know, what a coward. Look at how he responds. He says to this woman, why does he need Deborah? Is Deborah going to fight for him? Are we going to put a sword in Deborah's hand and have her lead the troops? No. Why do we need Deborah? He says, if you go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. Whoa, wait a minute. God is commanding you to go. You're not going to put a condition on this command and say, really, your trust is more in Deborah than it is in God, in some sense. This is something that is very negative. When you first read this, you just want to throw Barak just completely under the bus, you know, and say, wow, this is terrible. And yet, when you read Hebrews 11 and you read the list of the heroes of faith, you see that despite his weakness in his faith, despite his struggles and the fact that this was a difficult challenge, remember how hard this mission is. He's being asked to do what looks like like a suicide mission, not just for himself personally, not just for his friends, for his whole country. He's being asked to lead them into something that looks like sure death. And yet, in Hebrews 11, he is praised in conjunction with Gideon, in conjunction with Samson. He is in the list of those that we are to admire as having gone before us as a testimony of what God accomplishes through faith. That he is a hero for his faith. It's interesting that Deborah is not listed, you know, along there. Not that she's not to be commended. She is. But it's just interesting that Barak gets that type of commendation. We don't want to be too harsh against Barak. I like the one commentary on the book of Judges. And it's called Hands of Iron, Feet of Clay by Gary Inrick. I use that book quite a bit. Hands of Iron, Feet of Clay. In other words, recognize that there's this tension between being strong in the Lord and being a valiant warrior for the Lord, and yet our own weakness and our own sinfulness and the things that cause our faith to be weak, and yet God works with us. God works with these men like Gideon and Samson and Barak to make them into heroes, to make them into people that have lasting memories of accomplishing something great and mighty because of God's might and him strengthening them. And that's what happens in this situation here. And so he gets his marching orders, just like we have our marching orders. I mean, we have the Great Commission. It's not given as an option. It's not saying, you know, well, if you want to give testimony to me, since I've left you here on earth, it would kind of be nice if every once in a while you would mention to others something about how I've saved you and something about my grace that's available to them and something about the wrath of God that is hanging over them. It might be nice if you would give a mention now and then. God says, no, you are called to be my witnesses. You are to go, if going is what is required. You are to make disciples of all nations. You are to teach them to observe all that I commanded you. You're to baptize, you're to teach, you're to indoctrinate, you're to build them up, disciple them. This is a command, a mandate that we have as our mission. Well, he has his marching orders here, and he's very hesitant to perform them. Even though his name, Barak, means lightning, he wasn't too quick in this instance to come forth with what was needed, but eventually he does. And so I find it very parallel to the situation with Moses in Exodus chapter 33, where God calls Moses, and Moses has all this initial hesitation. And, you know, it's difficult for me to speak, Lord. And God said, I'll give you the words to speak. Let's just remove that as any consideration. That shouldn't be a hesitant. You know, I don't know if you really understand. I mean, I'm really not that good at speaking. And God gets upset with him. And God says, look, I'm going to send Aaron. I've taken some of the honor away from you. I've taken some of the recognition and some of the focus away from you. I'm going to distribute it over here to Aaron. But you're still going to go. You're still going to do what I've called you to do. And it's very similar to what happens here with this partnership between Barak and Deborah. But I think rather than this hesitation speaking to cowardice on the part of Barak, I think it more highlights the prominence of Deborah, the respect that we should have for Deborah, that his view of Deborah was, when she speaks, it's God speaking. I know that she's a prophetess. I know that I can rely on what she says. She's going to be able to say, now's the time to go into battle. She's going to be able to say, this is the strategy. Go this way, don't go that way. I'm going to need her insight. I'm going to need her closeness to God. She's got that close connection to God, and Barak is speaking to some extent that he doesn't have as close a connection to God, and his faith is not as strong as it should be, but it really speaks of the prominence of Deborah in terms of how he so much respected her role there. And so Deborah agrees to go forward, and they don't have much give and take like they did with God and Moses. You don't see all the back and forth. There maybe was some little back and forth, but the end result is that they go together in this partnership. And so in verses 9 to 16, you see the providential rout of Sisera's troops by Barak and Deborah. Despite the superior weaponry of these 900 iron chariots, despite that it looks like a suicide mission, God brings about a miraculous victory through the obedient faith of his people. And so God is able to just rout the enemy. So it says, then Deborah arose, and she went with Barak to Kedesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali, the people of these tribes, together. Isn't it interesting that he's able to marshal 10,000 troops? for this mission. And that's quite impressive when you look at what they are coming together to try to accomplish and the odds against them. That shows the impact of effective leadership. As God uses Deborah and Barak in this position of leadership, they're able to marshal 10,000 troops on this difficult mission. Now, what's this interesting aside here is interesting because of how it's going to come into play later. It mentions this Heber, the Kenite. And, of course, you had the Kenites and their relationship to Moses, through Moses' father-in-law. And they sort of were a nomadic tribe up in the northern area there. They moved around, sort of a Bedouin type of existence. And they sort of tried to play nice with everybody. I mean, they weren't super military in their focus. They would sort of have alliances with Israel and play nice there. But apparently they had this connection, it says, with Sisera and Jabin. They had some, the Kenites had connection with them as well. And so they just sort of played both sides of the fence. But it's just an interesting note that this Heber, he separated himself. So now he's geographically, he's located his family and his tents in the area right near where this battle is going to take place. So it's just giving us a little geographic reference that there's going to be these people that are not Israelites that seem to have some alliance with Jabin and his forces. So they would seem to be friendly. Sisera would find them to be a haven of safety, a refuge type of place. So it sets us up for later on when they're going to be more prominent in the story. And also, it might be that the Kenites are the ones that are sort of passing some of this intelligence back and forth about what the Israelites are doing and where these troops are. And it's, you know, it's a little difficult to read, but some military information is being given to Sisera so that he knows when Barak has gone up to Mount Tabor and is gathering his troops, so that Sisera knows to marshal all of his troops, and we're going to have this tremendous battle. So you get everybody aligned here in this place, and it's interesting, the reference is near the river Kishon, because this is the important military strategic aspect of the story that's not brought out until chapter 5. I mean, as you read through the story, you don't really see any explanation in chapter 4 other than that God is the one giving the victory, but there's no natural circumstances that play into this. But how did the undermanned infantry of Israel, how did they defeat 900 iron chariots? It just says, Deborah says to Barak, arise, this is the day which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Look at the emphasis upon the Lord, the activity of the Lord. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. So Barak goes down and sees these men fleeing, you know, running down, charging down this Mount Tabor into the plains there. And it says, and the Lord routed Sisera. And that word routed is the same word for bringing confusion, bringing panic upon the troops. It's used in the Egyptians where they crossed the Red Sea there and they were confused as the waters came over them and they were panicked and they just were all drowning. Well, what happened here is a natural phenomenon where God is controlling the forces of nature. He's having Sisera have the expectation that in this dry season, it's perfectly fine to wage battle in this plain with our chariots. But God sends, all of a sudden, this huge storm. And he causes this small stream bed, he causes it to flood out. And all of a sudden, what you got is all this mud miring down the chariots and making them not just useless, but making them a negative, you know, place where your troops are captured now, and they can't be effective in these chariots. And so it says from chapter 5, it talks about what happens with the water there and how he brings this about. And so it says in verse 4, it says of chapter 5, it says, Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth quaked, the heavens also dripped, even the clouds dripped water. The mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord. And then it goes on and talks, I don't know that I have the verses. Pardon me? Verse 20, there it is. Verse 21, the torrent of Kishon. This is a little creek bed. There's no water in this. And all of a sudden it goes from a little creek bed to the torrent of Kishon. Swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. And so they're giving praise to the Lord for what he did to then confound the troops. You can imagine when the confidence of Sisera's troops are in the fact that they have this great military advantage. And then they're surprised by having that counteracted by this flood situation, you can imagine the panic that ensued as to what have we gotten ourselves into. We completely have misjudged, we have miscalculated what our strength is and how we're going to be able to win this battle. And so God threw them into such a state of confusion and panic. It's almost like instances where God brings the troops to almost fight against themselves, and they just are of no use. They can no longer be commanded. And in fact, Sisera himself gives up, and he flees the battlefield, just trying to save his own skin. And so you have just a complete chaotic situation here, where God just lays out and exposes the enemy and says, here they are, easy pickings. Just go have your way with them and just collect them one after another and do away with them. And so that's the type of route that the Lord laid on these enemies here. And so we move to the part that we had overlooked before, verses 17 to 22. Let's read the end of chapter 4. It says, now Sisera fled away on foot. And of course, he's exhausted. And you can imagine the situation he's in. He's in a complete state of exhaustion. He thinks he's fortunate to stumble upon the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazar, and the house of Heber the Kenite. Yeah, there was peace also. You know, they're sort of playing both sides of the fence, but he thinks he's got an ally here. And so Jael, the wife here, goes out to meet Sisera, goes out from her tent, and said to him, turn aside, my master, turn aside to me, do not be afraid. And he turned aside to her into the tent. It's very, now again, in their custom, it would be very unusual circumstance for a man who's not your husband to come into the tent of a woman here. Yet she invites him in, promises protection, and covers him up, not for the purpose of warmth, but to hide him. She's covering him up with a rug. She's overtly looking like she's going to offer both hospitality and protection and going to hide him. And so she says, he says, well, please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty. She opens a bottle of milk or yogurt or some type of, I think it's some type of a drink that would help put him to sleep, too. I think it's something that's going to facilitate going to sleep a little bit easier. So she's giving him something different than what he asked for. She opens a bottle of milk, gave him a drink, covers him, and he said to her, look, stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, is there anyone here, that you shall say no. That seems like a surprise. Why would the person just look in the tent anyway? But if he does, hopefully wouldn't see anybody because they're covered with the rug. So they're working on some protection status here, and he has some aspect of security, but he's so exhausted he can't really check things out that carefully. And so he goes ahead, he goes to sleep. In verse 21, we see this Jael. She's not like I can't see our wives doing pulling this one off here. But you have to understand that. wait a minute. Katie says, "Don't underestimate me." Katie says, "So." They were used to, the women were used to setting up tents, taking down tents. They were used to using this maul, this heavy, not a little hammer, this is a heavy maul and a big tent peg. I mean, they were used to using these and putting up the tents, taking them down. So she goes, he's out, he's asleep, he's gone, okay? And she goes and says she grabs the hammer, the tent peg, and she went secretly to him and she drove the peg into his temple and it went through into the ground. What a picture. I mean, that is just, the Lord gives us all the gruesome details. I love the Old Testament stories. That's fun. And so, he was sound asleep. He was exhausted. So he died. Yeah, I guess he did die. So behold, as Barak, here's Barak. Here's Barak, huffing and puffing, and Barak, he's just been doing all he could to finish off the enemy and make sure that he took care of them. And now he still has this on his agenda. It's no good unless you get the king. You've got to be able to kill the king. And you can imagine how he's just beside himself. I've got to do this one more thing, but God's giving me victory. God's doing so much for me. And yet, God's not going to give him the honor of being the one to kill Sisera. So Jael comes out to meet Barak and says, well, come. I'll show you the man whom you're seeking. You're putting all this effort into this, and it's already done in a humiliating fashion. What a humiliation for Sisera, first of all, to leave the battlefield and not be with his troops. That's humiliating. Second of all, to be killed by a tent peg through the temple. I mean, that's humiliating. And by a woman, that's extremely humiliating. So, I mean, Sisera, it couldn't have been a worse death for him. And she has her trophy now. She has her trophy to show off to Barak. And so he entered, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with the tent peg. This is the fulfillment of the prophecy that Deborah had given in a way that was difficult to understand, because we thought, oh, it must be Deborah she's talking about, but it wasn't. She'd been talking about Jael. And so, on that day, it says, God subdued, on that day, Jabin. Now, just remember, Sisera was just the pawn of who was behind the scenes. It's really the forces of good, of God, fighting against Jabin, fighting against Satan and his forces. And really, you know, you have this, there's so many pictures here, just like it talks about Christ being the seed of the woman and being able to effectively stamp out the serpent's head. And what happens here with Sisera in the tent peg through the head. And yet, here you have God subduing Jabin, the king of Canaan, and the hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. And at the end of chapter 5, it goes on to how you would expect the story to finish. The land was undisturbed for 40 years. So what you would expect as being that slippage aspect where they get into that prosperity, but they don't take advantage of it. That aspect is found at the end of chapter 5, where the land was undisturbed for 40 years. And so we see here the message of the passage is that God can deliver his people. He can save by many, or he can save by few. He can save by using chariots and sophisticated weapons, or he can use an ox goad and a slingshot. He can raise up mighty warriors, or he can work in surprising ways through women like Deborah and Jael in positions of leadership. He controls all the forces of nature so that he can bring a flood and he can bring a storm and he can bring whatever he wants to compensate for despite the overwhelming odds, he can bring about salvation. He wants us to praise him. Chapter 5 we look at next week will be the praise, the thanksgiving, the glorifying of God for the tremendous victory that he brings. But whatever is troubling you, you might be dealing still with issues of eternal salvation, of, you know, can God really save me? I mean, for all of eternity, is God really able to save me? This account says God is able to deliver. He is able to bring the victory. Or we might be just as believers struggling with some pattern of sin in our life where we just can't seem to get the victory. God says, I can give you the victory. It's a victory that I give you by grace through faith. We have to call upon him for mercy and truly repent and place faith in him. There are no iron chariots that the enemy has that are powerful enough to hold you in any type of bondage or any type of oppression. It's all about the Lord. It's all about his ability to rout the enemy on our behalf so that he would have all of the glory.